Risks are always things to take account of. Russell Lamberti joins us now. Russell, thanks for coming on to the show this week. We last week had a couple of your colleagues from Panda who were giving us some really good insights into why they believe that the lockdown has been a disaster for South Africa and terribly exaggerated. I think they said, both Nick Hudson and Peter Castleton, that there was merit in the first 3 weeks to get the healthcare system ready, but the subsequent 5 weeks, their numbers show that, or certainly your numbers at Panda show, that perhaps has not been that smart a view. I'm now reading stuff, and I'm not sure if you read the latest report newspaper where R.W. Johnson has been saying this is an unmitigated disaster, and it's something that generations of South Africans are going to pay for. David says, we mustn't argue with you because you're far too clever. So we're all listening very carefully. If you can unpack the way you're seeing things and the way the economy is going to be impacted.
Thanks, Alec. It's good to be with you. I hope I'm coming through all right. So you've summed it up fairly well. I would probably take a slightly harder line than Nick and Peter. I've been skeptical of the lockdown pretty much from day one. You know, I think that the burden of proof, Alec, to shut down life as we know it, to shut down society, business, you know, congregating, just everything that is social life, to bring a complete stop to that, I think the burden of proof should be extremely high. And what we got was a couple of dodgy models from epidemiologists. We got some fear in the media. Just to say nothing about the actual severity of the virus, which can be debated, certainly could have been debated back then. It's getting more clarity now. But the burden of proof, I think, was very high. So I think from day one, this unleashed what has become a very big disaster. Now, look, if it had been capped at 3 weeks, if it had been just the 21 days, and we'd gone straight from that into a full open economy again with, you know, with the usual risk mitigation measures that we recognize we need, you know, I think we probably could have just about come out of this okay and escaped the worst of it. You know, 3 weeks is a little bit like a December holiday, and you could almost have justified that sort of situation, and perhaps we could have foregone a real December holiday at the end of this year to you know, maybe make up for that or something to that effect. But once we started pushing beyond the 3 weeks, once we pushed it to five, once we started creating tremendous uncertainty around levels, different levels, level five, level four, when is it going to be? And now we've pushed on to what will become, I think, about 9 weeks of pretty hard lockdown. Yeah, I think this has opened up a real can of worms in terms of hunger, poverty, destroyed businesses. Many, many marginal small businesses are closing, and many of them won't come back. And I mean, we could go on and on. I think there's so much that one could talk about here. And what we've done in the Panda Initiative really is just to take this intuition, which is, hang on a minute, if you close down life and if you close down the economy, this is not a situation of, you know, lives versus money or something trite like that. This is saying that how we live, this is how we sustain ourselves. And if you start destroying the productive capacity of society, if you start destroying businesses, if you start creating mass unemployment, you're going to get second, third, fourth round effects that you didn't quite anticipate at the start, right? And one of those is a certain group of people in particular that are right on the margins, they're right on the edge of that margin between just about sustaining themselves and what we would know as extreme poverty. It's not just those people that we're concerned about, of course, but it's that group that can really shift into that extremely vulnerable place where we know health outcomes are worse, mortality goes up. And so we were taking that intuition and trying to put some numbers to it versus, you know, what are we losing versus what are we gaining on this lockdown? We just don't think it's close. You know, we really don't think it's even a close call. It's manifestly so much worse to have done what we've done.
If you have a look at the history, and I guess there always is a way of understanding today if we look back into the past, But at one point in time, it did seem like, for instance, the UK was going to continue almost like the Swedish effect, where they would tell their people to have social distancing, but they wouldn't lock down the economy. Then you got the report that came out from Imperial College, which said, left to its own devices, this virus will kill 550,000 people in Britain and 2.2 million in the United States. And that seemed to shock everybody. I guess the question now is, why was that data not better analyzed? Because it looks at worst, the UK and the US will have 1/10 of those mortalities.
Yeah, and of course, the counter argument to that is that the people who, if you like, support the imperial approach would say that, we're now living in the counterfactual to that original scenario. The original scenario was, if you don't do anything but having lockdown, oh, look, now you've gotten all these benefits, and we can't know what life would have been like if we hadn't locked down. Thankfully, therefore, we have countries that have not locked down that give us a sense on how wrong the imperial model was. If you look at the imperial model estimations for Sweden, for example, way above where Sweden's actual infection and death, you know, outcomes have been. Sweden, of course, has not done nothing, but it's generally relied on its people to take the necessary precautions. And that's actually been my argument from day one, is that in such a complex problem, this, you need to diffuse and to decentralize risk management decisions. You can't expect one person to make a risk management call for 60 million people or for 300 million people or a billion people. This is not how real world risk management works. Everyone faces a radically different set of trade-offs in their life. Some people don't need to work. They can stay at home. Some people have to work. Some people are young. Some people are old. Some people live far from towns or close to towns. And this is a hugely complex issue. And I think all things considered, you know, there's no perfect government. There's no perfect country. But all things considered, I think we're going to see the Swedish approach, you know, resoundingly affirmed by the evidence. Not only are they experiencing a pandemic or an epidemic pretty much in line with their European peers, but the early indications are that their economy is doing way better than everyone else's. And that's notwithstanding the fact, of course, that being an open economy like Sweden, you're going to suffer the results of everyone else's shutdown. You know, it's going to hit your trade. It's going to hit your imports and export sector. It's going to affect you. But even outside of that, Sweden is performing considerably better on the economic front. And that just stands to reason. They haven't shut everything down. They haven't forced production to stop. They haven't closed restaurants. They haven't done all these things. So yes, I think it was predicated on a model, and you know this is an important line of inquiry, Alec. You know, why did we let a single model with pretty speculative inputs that were untested and unproven determine such big policy choices? I don't have a great answer for you on that, but somewhere along the line, there's a real deficiency in the democratic and in the sort of decision making process, I think. Somewhere along the line, fear, an excessive reliance on very speculative modeling, and somewhere along the line, that the processes that should hold that decision in check, that should disallow such a big decision to go through without, as I say, a very big burden of proof, that's all just fallen apart. And that's, we've seen that not only in South Africa, but we've seen it in the UK, we've seen it in parts of America, we've seen it in most countries in the world. And that's, I think, a real unveiling, let's say, of a deficiency in a lot of modern democracies. So that's a, you know, if there's themes emerging from this now, things that we learn, one of them is that our political systems need some serious rethinking.
Well, perhaps that'll be one of the upsides out of this. But the question for you from our earlier conversation with Piet Viljoen is, and given that you straddle both worlds on the numbers side and the investment world, Pitt says that now he would put the chances of South Africa going on a Venezuela Zimbabwean route at about 20%, which is substantially higher than he was thinking pre-COVID. And of course, when one extrapolates that, you have to consider whatever investments you're making into JSE listed companies, even though some of them look terribly cheap at the moment, if that is a factor to really start worrying about. How are you reading that?
It's a sobering comment from Pete, who I know well and respect. And I think that he himself wouldn't say that 20% is a hard and fast probability. I think the fact that you're even talking, that anyone could be plausibly talking about 5, 10 or 20%, you know, even 1% chance of us going down that particular pathway, I think speaks to how bad things have become in South Africa, because those sorts of trajectories, the Zimbabwe-Venezuela trajectory is really the worst case. You know, it's basically as bad as it gets, apart from outright war, outright sort of civil war and ultimate destruction. Because when you go down those sorts of routes, everything becomes dysfunctional. Markets, as you know, they've become conventionally uninvestable, really. Property rights break down. You can't really even be that secure in your share certificates that you might hold in that particular environment. It all sort of, you know, all bets are off in that sort of world. So to get into the nitty gritty of that idea, I guess the thing has always been, to what degree is South Africa susceptible to outright political corruption that causes your central bank, first and foremost, to be plundered, that causes your central bank essentially to be captured, to be fully captured for very nefarious and narrow political ends. And of course, the result there is that money gets printed and the currency gets debased. And in that scenario, the rand obviously would come under more pressure than we've ever known, you know, even worse than the early mid 80s, even worse than the early 2000s. We would see a currency, under huge threat. We would see a large immigration wave from the country. There's already been a large immigration wave that would continue. And I suppose in that scenario, I mean, there's a few things to say. The one is, from a big asset allocation perspective, is that you actually want to be getting out of bonds and cash. So there are certain equities in that world that can protect your wealth. Companies that have offshore exposure really just become the only sort of game in town. So if you go back to the Zimbabwe days, it was Old Mutual as a big dual listed stock. And a similar thing would sort of start to happen in the SA context. You would get a huge crowding into your rand hedge stocks if there hasn't been one already. And you would have to sort of play it in that way. And obviously then you would have to just try and offshore your assets as best as you could, as early as you could. You'd have to try and avoid capital controls, because that would be the inevitable result. Now, where are we on that timeline? You know, the Reserve Bank remains a well-run institution, all things considered, as far as central banks go. I was once quite a big critic, but I'm quite admiring of Lesetša Kanyako and most of his team. They've held the line. They've been relatively firm. You know, I think that the Ramaphosa administration, along with Mr. Mboweni as the finance ministry, broadly respect and get that the central bank shouldn't be meddled with and shouldn't be used as a political tool. I think that there's a huge faction in the ANC that would love to use the central bank as a political tool and a money printing machine. And of course, now that we've come into this corona crisis, I guess the window of what's considered acceptable monetary policy has started to shift. You know, we're getting an acceptance that, you know, liquidity provision and money printing and QE, as much as the SARB tries to deny the word quantitative easing, they are basically buying bonds from the banks. They're first and foremost re-liquefying the banking system, shoring up bank balance sheets with printed money. It's not in massive scale yet. So far, it's been kind of fairly measured, but it's beginning. And once that process starts, what we learn from the Fed and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and all these guys, it's very hard to reverse that process once it begins. And emerging markets don't have a good track record of managing such a process well. And markets punish emerging markets a lot more than they do developed markets when they misbehave at a sort of money printing level. So these are certainly risks. But right now, so Pete's right. That risk has certainly increased. And I guess analytically, we've just got to keep really beady eyes on what's going on at the central bank, how the politics of South Africa's central bank and monetary policy, you know, is evolving.
Russell Lamberti, as you can see from the screen there, he is the co-author of a book with a little Zimbabwean flag in, so he knows what he's talking about on that side, and also he's a member of the at Panda. Russell, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your inputs and lots of words of caution there and room for thinking more deeply about it.